David Moskowitz, welcome to KNKX. Thanks for taking the time.
Good to be here with you.
So the book is called Caribou Rainforest, and the cover image shows a bull peering out between some trees. Is this book more about the caribou or the rainforest?
The book is about the rainforest, and the caribou is the ambassador for this really unique ecosystem. So you learn about the rainforest through the eyes and life of the caribou and how it interacts with the entire ecosystem.
And where exactly is this rainforest located? It's literally hundreds of miles from an ocean.
It's the headwaters of the Columbia and Fraser Rivers, primarily a little bit of the upper end of the Peace River as well, but it is draped across a whole series of mountain ranges, including the Selkirks, Purcells, Caribou Mountains, Monashies, and even the western edge of the Rocky Mountains in Canada and all the way over to northwestern Montana.
So you became fascinated with this landscape. You've written two other books. What was the fascination with this landscape and this animal?
Yeah, so the project kind of started on a whim for me. I had a month all of a sudden open up in my schedule a number of years ago because I had expedition cancel at the last minute. And I decided to go searching for mountain caribou that I'd read about and written about, but never actually been able to see or photograph. And I thought it'd be fun to go try to find these animals. They live in a beautiful part of the world. And I wanted to see them with my own eyes and photograph them. I thought an interesting essay might come out, photo essay might come out of it. But when I went up into the region and I learned more about just how unique the ecosystem was and how truly imperiled caribou were, I got much more interested. And during that first month, when I realized that we were actually actively destroying their habitat, even as we were trying to protect them through the Endangered Species Act or the Species at Risk Act in Canada, I really realized that this was, from a conservation perspective, like storytelling thing, like this was amazing. I was literally driving up the road into the places I was told was like the best habitat for mountain caribou, and I was watching their habitat come down the road on logging trucks. So the reality that we're cutting old growth rainforests in the 21st century and endangered species habitat was really too much of a story for me to ignore.
Yeah, it's hard to believe that that's even allowed.
It is. It's happening a day's drive from Seattle or Vancouver in two of theoretically the more progressive nations on the planet is really pretty astounding.
So back to the animals for a moment. Are caribou like reindeer or are they different?
Mountain caribou are a distinct ecotype of caribou. Caribou is one species. You can find it all over the Northern Hemisphere. In Europe, they're called reindeer. So same species, but distinctively different subspecies and ecotype of caribou. And the specific thing about mountain caribou that makes them truly unique is how they have adapted their life cycle to live in this rainforest. So nowhere else on planet Earth do caribou undergo a double migration. They actually migrate up and down the mountainsides twice every year. And they're an obligate of old growth forests throughout the year. They need old growth forests to survive, both because their primary food is arboreal lichens that grow in abundance on these old trees. And then also the forest itself act as their refuge because no other hoofed animals can really survive in large tracts of old forest. They just can't make it work. And so because of that, caribou had the entire ecosystem to themselves without any competitors and really without many predators because they spread out across that huge forest and it wasn't worth the time of wolves or mountain lions, things like that, to really try to make a living feeding on them because they were just really well protected in that vast expanse of forest.
Well evolved. So there's a movie too. You got really into this and produced a film about it. I wanted to play an excerpt. It really sets up the theme of the whole project really well.
Some of the last remaining tracts of uncut inland temperate rainforest have been protected as critical habitat for the endangered mountain caribou. However, this has not been enough to stop their decline. And if these caribou go extinct, not only will our planet lose a magnificent creature, but these ancient forests will likely fall with them.
So there you have it. How many are there left?
Mountain caribou, the whole population, there's probably about 11 or 1,200 animals left. And that's spread out across an area that's thousands of square miles. So it seems like, well, that's pretty good, but it's actually subdivided into about a dozen subgroups that actually many of them don't have any connection with each other. So they've become isolated and these smaller fragmented populations are critically endangered. The biggest cohesive group is a few hundred animals within that entire population. So they're, you know, across their range, critically threatened with imminent extinction.
And they're very elusive. You describe the process of finding them in your film really nicely. Another excerpt from it, just to describe that a little bit. One of your co-authors, Marcus Reinerson, he's a wildlife tracker, talks about what it was like doing this work.
Yeah, so this is going to be our base camp for the next couple nights. And while where we are is home and refuge to one of the largest remaining herds of mountain caribou, they're still really challenging to find. They make a living in places where not many other things like to go. So in a sense, it's like trying to find a needle in a haystack.
So it must have just been so hard to do your work. You did rely a lot on these camera traps to take images. What's that process like?
Yeah, so, you know, as Marcus said, basically their whole survival strategy is to like blend into the landscape, to disappear into the forest. And they've often been called the ghosts of the rainforest. And so when that's your strategy, then it gets really hard to find you, especially when your numbers start dwindling. So there's not many of them left. So actually the first year and a half of our field work was very frustrating. We'd get a few glimpses of them now and again, but it wasn't until we really started working on camera trapping that we were able to nail down some really, you know, kind of engaging images of some of these caribou in some of the habitat that's harder to catch them in, or some of those last few animals right on the border with the United States. Camera trapping was integral to that. And then also for capturing images of a bunch of the other species that they share the rainforest with, grizzly bears and wolves and, you know, all sorts of other cool critters.
But to get the caribou, the mountain caribou, you would like maybe put a camera where a salt lick was located, where other researchers were doing work, or their migration path?
Yeah, for all the images of caribou, we didn't use any attractants. We didn't import anything. We were just setting up cameras in places where we thought the caribou would go. So that was like along game trails in areas where they were frequenting, or at a natural mineral lick where they were coming to visit. Because that's the other nice thing about camera traps is they're really non-invasive. So we could set them up and then leave, and then they wouldn't disturb the animals while they're out there, as opposed to a human being in a blind or anything like that can have a lot more of an impact. So we wanted to not have any of our documentary work negatively impact the animals we were trying to tell a story about.
What was it like kind of opening the trap afterward to find out what was in there?
It can be like Christmas if you get something good, but sometimes you'll show up and it's like been sitting out for a month and then a rabbit has come and like chewed through a cable. And so it didn't stop working 3 days out, or the batteries died, or a bear ripped it up. So you really never know what you're going to get, you know, when you're setting up a studio, you know, photography studio in the wilderness to photograph a wild creature. And sometimes it works out great and sometimes it goes really sideways. So always an adventure for sure.
Mm. And the project took 3 years to complete, I think. Is that especially long?
That was a pretty significant amount of time for this. You know, the project, it's the story is very complicated, and the human dynamics are really interesting. And then the caribou themselves, you know, you need to document them in every season of the year to really tell their whole story. And then there's all these other accessory, you know, creatures and different parts of the rainforest to visit. So it was a lot of work, and we were really committed to telling the story well, and to really not just give it a soundbite explanation, because that's actually one of the most interesting parts about this story, is it really is a fascinating parable of ecology and then conservation in the 21st century. And if you just do a soundbite explanation for what's going on up there, you really miss the deeper meaning, the tragedy, and the opportunity that this story has to share.
You saw the landscape change a lot, even as you were in process in those 3 years. What was happening on the land?
Well, certainly the dynamics for that last herd of caribou on the U.S.-Canadian border was shifting, you know, and actually, as I'm doing this book tour, is right when the last few animals were extirpated from that herd. So that was noticeable.
Explain that a little bit. The remaining six were moved from the U.S. into Canada?
Yeah, the last few animals, there's two southernmost herds. One of them almost came down into the U.S. The other one did come down into the U.S. And the last animals from both of those herds, or almost all of the animals from both of those herds, and definitely all the animals that were coming down into the U.S., were removed by British Columbia and put into a pen further north, where they're scheduled to be released into a larger, more stable herd up there. So British Columbia has committed to working on a captive breeding program to support reintroduction efforts once they can figure out all the details about how to do that in partnership with tribes on the U.S. side of the border and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. But there's no legally binding obligation for them to do that. So what the future holds for caribou on the U.S. side of the border really is very murky at this point.
Why did the U.S. let them go?
Well, the animals were captured in British Columbia, so it was out of their jurisdiction. You know, British Columbia could do whatever they wanted with them legally. I think the bigger question, that question really lends itself to how could we have been doing conservation work on mountain caribou for 30 or 40 years in some instances and have watched that kind of continuously like not work. And that's been going on both north and south of the border. And the answer to that question is really twofold. One is the vested economic interests, and specifically the timber industry. And then secondarily, some of the ecotourism, heli-skiing, snowmobiling interests further north of the border really hampered the types of robust conservation measures that needed to be taken to protect them. Because essentially, in order to really restore the ecosystem that these animals depend on to survive, you would have had to drastically alter how logging was being carried out across the, or you would still have to do that in order to create natural ecological conditions in which caribou could survive. And then secondarily to that, some of the more invasive measures to prop up caribou populations that needed to be done in order to keep them alive were very distasteful to parts of the conservation community. So when you log extensively in mountain caribou habitat, it increases the populations of moose, elk, and deer. And that in turn increases the populations of wolves and mountain lions and black bears, things like that. And then that increases the predation rate on caribou. So in the long run, it's the destruction of the forest that's creating the conditions for caribou to disappear. But in the short run, the thing that's actually killing them are native predators. And so one of the conservation efforts that's been initiated in places is killing carnivores. And because there's such a long history of killing carnivores for very ecologically unsound reasons, that is a move that many conservationists fought very hard against. And then the third thing that really is underplaying what's going on with caribou north and south of the border is basically racism against indigenous people and their rights, both by international law and treaty. So the continued ignoring of treaty rights of tribes and First Nations, and then the ignoring of international norms about how you deal with unceded indigenous people's land has been underscoring the entire process of how the United States and Canada and British Columbia has dealt with caribou conservation. Hmm. That plays out when you ask a lot of conservationists or you ask folks from the BC government, they'll talk about the economics and how much it costs to conserve caribou. And when you ask Chief Roland Wilson of the West Moberly Doniza First Nation, he'll say that how British Columbia is managing forests and caribou is a continuation of centuries of genocide against his people. So I think there's two different narratives there. And a lot of times the media has worked pretty hard to tell the settler colonial story of it and has done a pretty wretched job of tending to the indigenous people's perspective on that, which is a classic story of settler colonialism in North America, unfortunately.
Yeah. Are the caribou living primarily on public lands or some private lands as well?
No, the vast majority of this ecosystem is public lands, crown lands, as it's called in Canada, that's managed by British Columbia. And then the U.S. part of it is almost all U.S. Forest Service public lands.
And explain again, what is so unique about this rare inland temperate rainforest? What's so special about it?
There's no place else like it on Earth. It's not a hyperbolic statement. Rainforests around the planet are pretty rare to begin with. Most of them are in the tropics. So when you get rainforests in the temperate regions of the world, away from the equator like we are, that is even more rare. And then most of those temperate region rainforests are on the coast. And you can find those on the coast of Europe and Asia, North America, South America, and Australia. But the only place left in the world where you can find a rainforest in the temperate regions of the world that's far from the ocean is right here in the Pacific Northwest. So that makes it truly one of the most unique terrestrial ecosystems on planet Earth.
And does the departure of the caribou from the U.S. parts of that rainforest mean possibly less protection for it here?
Yeah, so this is kind of an interesting part of the conundrum, the parable of this story, which is that for 15,000 years since the end of the last ice age, this forest protected the caribou. But then in the 20th century, when we established the Endangered Species Act, conservationists started advocating for using an endangered species to protect an ecosystem. So the protections afforded to caribou under the Endangered Species Act, or now the Species at Risk Act in Canada, that would protect habitat for that particular animal. And that would in turn provide an umbrella of conservation for many, many other species. And what we're now seeing is with the extirpation of the caribou, there will be challenges to those habitat protections, both north and south of the border. British Columbia has been very, very clear that if caribou disappear and it's deemed unfeasible for them to be reestablished, that the habitat protections for them would be lifted. And there would need to be some other justification to protect those forests. Otherwise, they would go back into the timber harvest land base. So that is a very real issue that we're facing. There's, I think, about 8,000 square miles of protected forests, uncut and old growth forests in British Columbia that could go back on the chopping block if caribou disappear. So it's a very big, real issue that's going to need to be addressed.
So how did your conversations with First Nations and Indigenous tribes influence your portrayal of the caribou and the landscape?
For me, conservation stories are not actually primarily biological stories. They're social and cultural issues. And so looking at the cultural dynamics that are playing out in this ecosystem was vital. And we were fascinated about all of the elements of it, whether it was like the historic settler colonial culture that still plays out in the resource extraction industry, or the influx of urban refugees that are involved with the ecotourism industry, and certainly the first people of that landscape, the Indigenous people north and south of the border, were instrumental in informing us of what is the story there, what is this landscape, what is the meaning of it, and how do humans fit into it as part of that ecosystem. So in particular, we were interested in the Indigenous perspectives of it, in part because journalistically they're often overlooked. And secondarily, because I think there's some very important ideas and messages from these people that we in a settler colonial culture really need to look at if we're going to think about how to find a sustainable future for ourselves and all the different creatures in this landscape. And that's one that I heard time and again that really looks at our relationship with the natural world as reciprocal rather than extractive. And so where we've developed an economy that's based on just the constant removal of resources from an ecosystem and the production of profits for people that, you know, are invested in corporations all around the world, the relationships, the way that many Indigenous people describe their relationships to this forest and these animals, was more akin to how you think about your family, and that there's a give and a take. And sometimes your family members give to you, and sometimes you give to your family members, but that relationship breaks down if it's one-sided. And so, you know, again, just a quote from Chief Roland Wilson was, the caribou were there for us, and now we need to be there for the caribou. That's what our elders told us. So there's the sense that for millennia, the caribou fed the Indigenous people of this landscape, and they saw it as an important part of their economy, that they gained sustenance from them. But now these Indigenous groups see that these caribou are in need, so it's their obligation to return the service that the caribou provided for them. And when you look at the natural world in that way, and you look at our relationship with it more akin to how we deal with our neighbors and our family members, it really changes the ethics and the economics of how we do business, not just in this ecosystem, in any ecosystem. So that was a really important part of the story for me, and a really important learning for me in this project.
Yeah, there was one quote that comes up a couple of times about how they regarded the caribou as almost like an insurance policy, as a food source, because they were once so abundant.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's like they knew where they could find them. If they were ever hungry, they could go to the mountains and get caribou. It's a story that you heard from different Indigenous groups from the south to the north end of this ecosystem, and it's recorded in the anthropological literature as well, which is fascinating given that now these animals are on the brink of extinction. And you realize in the past, they were literally, you know, a piece of the sustenance for dozens of different nations of people.
Yeah, I think he said they were like bugs on the landscape. It reminds me of how we used to be with salmon.
Right, exactly. It's a very similar story. Very, very similar story.
Yeah, and lots of people in the Northwest and the world actually right now are very concerned about the plight of our southern resident orca whales, to some extent also the Puget Sound, their habitat. Do you see parallels between that narrative that's playing out right now and the one
Very much so. Both of these species have what's called an extinction debt, which means that the landscape, the ecosystem in which they live, has changed around them. So they cannot survive in the long run in the current conditions that they face. And this is something we're going to see in more and more species as we move forward if we don't really drastically change how we treat the world around us. And even if we do, there's decades and centuries of cleanup work for us to do to make the world habitable again for many of these creatures that we've shared the world with since we've been human beings. And it's an economics issue. It's an issue of morals and ethics. It's an issue of culture. But, you know, one of the other things in the book that I talk about, I actually interviewed an outfitter, a hunting guide from the rainforest, and he's like, I can't remember his exact words, but essentially people that don't have the chance to interact with these animals, with big game and wild animals, they're missing out on what it means to be human, because we literally evolved into the species we are with these other creatures. So it's not just a matter of whether or not caribou survive. It's like we're literally talking about extinguishing a part of what it means to be human in the process that we're undergoing.
So the subtitle of your book is From Heartbreak to Hope. Do you feel more hopeful having worked on this project?
Yeah, you know, in the book and the film, we designed to kind of work in tandem. So the film is really an expose of the continued liquidation of this rainforest, which we need to deal with. And the book was very much a celebration of what is still a tremendous, beautiful, valuable, important, rich ecosystem. And so part of my hope comes from the reality that this ecosystem is still here. There are thousands and thousands of square miles of old growth forests and wild roadless mountain landscapes and beautiful alpine tundra. And it's just this amazing ecosystem. So we can do things differently here than we've done in other places. So there's an opportunity here. Just because the province of BC is planning on logging old growth forests for 40 years doesn't mean they have to. So there is 40 years worth of old growth forest logging that we can stop today. So that's one point of hope there. And then the other piece for me that I really grappled with, because there is so much pain here, there is kind of a sense of an unfolding tragedy here. I really learned that, and this comes a lot from, you know, the work of Joanna Macy and some of her colleagues, just the idea that we can't ignore the pain, that the fact that we feel distress when we see ecosystems that are in trouble and species that are in trouble is actually a very healthy thing. And it's part of us being a part of the family of life. And our experiencing of that pain is like we are the pain receptors for this ecosystem. And that just the same way, if you put your hand on a stove and it's hot, you take it off. That pain is telling you to take remedial action to heal things. And so the more we can sink into that and feel that and own that, that is the driver and inspiration for change. And then the final piece, and I talk about this in the conclusion of the book, is just looking to the people and the creatures of this ecosystem for inspiration. Again, to quote Chief Roland Wilson, he said, "We've been here for thousands of years. We're not going anywhere. We're going to be here long after the province is done raping and pillaging this landscape, and we're going to clean up this mess." And so just this reality that it's like there's not an option for caribou or for the indigenous people of this landscape or for the settlers that have come and called this place home and put a stake in the ground, that this is their home. And like in the same way that people will do whatever they can to protect their literal physical home or their children or the children of their extended family, that sense of love and urgency and care for family and home and community, the more we can tap into that and extend our sense of family to a larger subset of the world, from just our immediate offspring to like other people's kids, to other communities' children, to other species' children, that there's just an endless well of love and hope and energy to push for positive change in the world. And so I really believe by just helping people own the pain that they feel, tap into the love and the beauty of this world, and create a sense of kinship with other living beings, that there is a recipe for us to create a different future.
And as rare as they are, there are still mountain caribou to photograph.
That is true. And as long as there is an ecosystem there to be exploring, you know, I certainly hope folks are getting out there and building a sense of connection to that place and using that as the jumping off point to push for positive change in how we manage our culture and our economy, not just there, but in ecosystems around the planet.
David Moskowitz, author of Caribou Rainforest, From Heartbreak to Hope. Thank you so much for joining me.
You got it. My pleasure.